Case number 21-1655, Stephen Moss versus Gary Menard. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Shimkus for the appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Scott Shimkus appearing on behalf of Respondent. I believe I've reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal. This case really boils down to three main points that should have precluded habeas relief in this case. So first, the petition was late and Moss is not entitled to equitable tolling. Second, that the claims are procedurally defaulted and those defaults cannot be excused. And third, on the merits, that prejudice cannot be presumed and is otherwise lacking. In ruling to the contrary, the district court essentially found that not one fair-minded jurist could agree with the state court's decisions in this case under the AEDPA standard. And so we ask this court to reverse. So going first to the issue of timing, while it's not a jurisdictional issue, it most certainly is a threshold issue, in this case in particular, because the district court granted habeas relief. And so a petition cannot be granted unless the petition was timely. If it was not timely, it cannot be granted. And so the district court determined that the petition was untimely, but that the petitioner was entitled to equitable tolling. And that was on a very specific ground. It was on the basis that 2016 was a leap year, and so it caused some confusion, at least allegedly, for habeas counsel in terms of not filing the habeas petition, but for filing the motion for relief from judgment in the state courts. It was filed, that motion was filed 1 day after the limitations period concluded. And so there was no statutory tolling whatsoever, and that's why the habeas petition ultimately was 14 months late. And they allege sort of a different ground now on appeal, where they try to say that this court has developed essentially two paths to statute of limitations calculations, one being the anniversary method under the published Brunga case, and a second method under an unpublished Williams versus Wilson case. But I think that's really a sort of a false dichotomy here. There's really been no indication in any other case from this court that these two paths exist, and every time this court has to confront a statute of limitations calculation, that the court has to choose between Brunga and Williams. And not only that, but again, that point wasn't argued below. The only point argued below for equitable tolling was this notion of the leap year. They touch on the leap year now on appeal, but the true argument there was the leap year, and here it's essentially a different argument. And so
what's our standard of review for that issue?
So it is de novo, Your Honor. I did specifically look into this issue because there can be some confusion when it comes to statute of limitations in particular, whether the issue is de novo or abuse of discretion. But it's de novo here, as we pointed out in our briefing, and actually the appellees point out in their brief as well. They agree that the review is de novo because this is a question of law and because the facts are undisputed. The district court didn't need to make any factual determinations such that they would have to make credibility determinations, which then would be subject to an abuse of discretion standard. So,
and the district court, the rationale was because it was a leap year, and I think you're arguing that it doesn't even work.
Correct, Your Honor. It doesn't work because of the sort of the way, really, the calendar goes. Yeah. So there's only, you know, one leap day in a leap year, which is February 29th, and in 2016, that would have been February 29th of 2016, but the limitations period didn't start until March 21st, 2016, and so that year from March 21st, 2016 to March 21st, 2017 does not include a leap day. Now, their argument below was that a habeas counsel was confused because there are cases out there that talk about leap years, and that's absolutely true. There are certainly cases that talk about leap years. But all of those cases, the limitations period included the leap day. Now, they try to argue here on appeal to this court that this sort of state of the law was confusing to habeas counsel, and that no case has explicitly said, well, the leap year analysis has to include the leap day. It's enough if the year itself is a leap year, regardless of whether that's from January 1st to February 28th or even later. But I think the problem is that there's really a logical issue there, even if it's not necessarily a legal one that appears in this court's opinions. It should, a lawyer should be able to read those cases and understand that all of those limitations periods included a leap day. And so if Mr. Moss can't get past the timeliness of his petition, if he cannot get equitable tolling, then really the inquiry has to end there. He cannot be granted habeas relief on an untimely petition.
Why shouldn't he be entitled to equitable tolling when we couldn't manage to even get it right ourselves in our various opinions?
Well, Your Honor, the appellees point to a single specific opinion in terms of the calculation that they're talking about, right? So that's Williams versus...
I can't remember the specific cases, but there, I mean, we're not talking about one case. I mean, we're talking about various situations in which our court did not compute the time correctly and gave some incorrect guidance to litigate people who would bring such claims, right?
So I do want to correct myself. I think we're talking about Williams versus Wilson, and then there's another case, Fortson, that talked. There's some dicta about leap years in that case, but that case didn't turn on whether.
Well, weren't we wrong in some of our pronouncements on the computation?
My contention is that, unfortunately, I think Williams was mistaken in terms of the calculation there.
Why would someone not be entitled to rely on that such that equitable tolling might apply?
So for really two reasons, Your Honor. One is that that case was unpublished, and there's nothing in that opinion that says why the court did what they did. They didn't say, well, there are these differences in how we can approach this.
So if you're the habeas petitioner and it's in an unpublished opinion, you're supposed to presume it to be wrong?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. That's not my argument. My argument is that there is a published opinion that tells litigants the correct way to calculate the limitations period. And if you have a conflict between a published opinion and an unpublished opinion, the law says, and really logic says, that the published one is that you need to follow. And you might need to look at why the unpublished opinion did it the way they did, but if you have a published opinion that has a different approach and really the correct approach, then the published opinion is the one that needs to be followed. It really doesn't seem... I suppose correct to say that a single unpublished case in the face of competing published cases, that it wouldn't be excusable for counsel to rely on the unpublished case.
Counsel, are you going to go ahead and move on to the merits?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Sure. So, and just briefly before we get to that, there is a procedural default here that the petitioners need to overcome, or petitioner needs to overcome before... Again, a habeas petition can be granted on the merits, but going to the merits, I think there are really two problems here. So one is that they claim that the prejudice should be presumed under Cronic, and then there's sort of an additional problem that even if they can't rely on Cronic and they have to go to Strickland, which, of course, our position is that they do need to do that, there really is no prejudice argument under Strickland that the petitioner has made, that he had this reasonable probability of being acquitted at trial if some different approach had been taken. So looking to Cronic first about why prejudice can't be presumed, The petitioners are arguing here that essentially that counsel failed at specific points. They try to claim that, you know, they're looking at the picture as a whole and that there was a complete failure here. But they're talking about specific things that counsel didn't do, that counsel didn't look into witnesses before trial, that counsel waived the opening statement, you know, failed to cross-examine witnesses at trial. Those are failures, alleged failures, at specific points of the trial, not a complete abandonment of the client at trial.
But
the other problem,
reasonable, if you're going to talk about complete abandonment, that you'd have to fill that in with some of the specific things that counsel did not do that in the aggregate amount to complete abandonment. You can't just say, okay, complete abandonment,
sure,
without citing some examples, I would think.
The fact of presence does not negate complete abandonment.
Yes, and I understand your point, Your Honor, but they're still saying that these were specific things he didn't do, as opposed to saying he showed up at trial and did nothing. He did some things and didn't do some things. And if you have...
What did he do at trial?
So here, for one thing, he had a very specific reason for conducting the trial the way that he did, to get past, essentially, the trial court to the appellate courts to talk about entrapment. So he had a reason for doing what he did. And then what he did at trial is he stipulated with the prosecutor that both parties would waive their opening argument or their opening statements. He agreed to admitting most of the entrapment hearing testimony as far as the officers and the informants went, but he specifically objected to his client's testimony being admitted at the trial. And then he did cross-examine, at least to some extent, one of the witnesses because he wanted to challenge that witness's credentials to make a conclusion. And so counsel did do things at the trial. It's just that all of those things that he did, and really even more specifically the things he did not do, he had a very specific reason for.
I guess for me, you know, we're dealing with AEDPA deference here. So what we're trying to, what I'm struggling with is how can you say that the state court's ruling is within the range of acceptable interpretations of Chronic to say that it satisfied Chronic?
So I think the answer, Your Honor, is because, for one, the Supreme Court has never addressed this specific issue, which under Woods versus Donald, the Supreme Court has said you can't have cases that are just similar. You have to have cases on point if you're going to grant habeas relief. The other thing is that the Supreme Court has addressed at least one case in which there was essentially this walk-through trial in hopes of getting to a later proceeding. It admittedly is not cited in my brief, but the district court did cite it in Florida versus Nixon, where the trial counsel essentially did this, conceded guilt, did a walk-through trial on a capital murder case, and his point was to get to the penalty phase to try to argue against the death penalty.
You know, counsel, admittedly, my experience is in the federal system with as far as criminal cases go, but there's quite a lot of it. And I never heard of a lawyer who thought this kind of performance in an effort to get entrapment considered on appeal would be a good idea or any kind of reasonable strategy. Is a walk-through trial some kind of common concept in state courts?
I'm sorry. I see my time. Thank you, Your Honor. I certainly wouldn't say it's common, but it's not so uncommon that it's per se unreasonable for counsel to take such a course. In fact, we cited a state court case in my brief where this same strategy was employed, and it worked. The case got up to the Michigan Court of Appeals.
Yeah, it might work if you prevail on the pretrial issue, but you lose your opportunity to convince a single juror. You know, you lose many, many other opportunities.
I'll respond briefly to that, Your Honor, just because I do know my time is up. But in looking more at this case last night, this notion of, you know, there might be nothing to lose by doing a full-blown trial, the Supreme Court's addressed that too in Knowles versus Merzianz. And I believe that was... I have a specific page site here, I just want to make sure I'm thorough, on pages 121 to 122 of that opinion, where the Supreme Court rejected the idea that counsel needs to do something just because there's nothing to lose in pursuing it. For these reasons, we ask you to reverse, Your Honors, and I reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Ms. Barlow? Morning.
Good morning. My name is Estina Barlow, and I represent Mr. Stephen Moss. May it please the court. The state has emphasized that the writ of habeas corpus is reserved for extreme malfunctions of the criminal justice system, which is exactly what happened here. Mr. Moss was effectively without counsel in his criminal proceedings. His attorney, David Steingold, was so thoroughly ineffective that the state trial court interrupted the proceedings partway through to ask Steingold if he was trying to set up an ineffective assistance of counsel claim for appeal. Mr. Steingold's incompetence began the first day that he appeared, 10 days before the entrapment hearing. He was utterly unprepared for the entrapment hearing, failing to investigate, failing to interview witnesses, failing to speak to Mr. Moss, failing to speak to Mr. Moss's previous attorneys, and failing to review the evidence against Mr. Moss until the first day of the entrapment hearing. That utter lack of preparation left him completely unprepared to determine that entrapment was a viable defense and to litigate that defense in the entrapment hearing. When the entrapment motion was denied, Mr. Steingold then proceeded to effectively concede Mr. Moss's guilt, conducting an expedited stipulated facts bench trial that lasted all of 20 minutes.
Was there any, as far as the prejudice here for a Strickland claim, I mean, what exactly is the contention that could have been he could have done differently that would have been supported by the facts to defend the client?
So we haven't raised a Strickland claim here because it wasn't included in the habeas petition
okay,
below.
So it's chronic for both pretrial and trial.
That's correct, Your Honor. And as you know, under chronic, we...
You don't have to show prejudice.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly.
I'll ask you what I was asking your counterpart about chronic, because I understand AEDPA, you're supposed to be determining, could a reasonable jurist interpret chronic the way the state courts did, which was essentially to say, I think as long as you've done something, you haven't completely abandoned your client under chronic. So how do you respond to that?
Sure. So there's two specific aspects of the state court's decision that were clearly unreasonable and we think no fair-minded jurist could agree with. The first is that the state court entirely failed to recognize that there was a constructive denial of counsel pre-trial here as a result of Mr. Steingold's failure to investigate or consult with his client. And under this court's decision in Mitchell v. Mason, those failures qualify Mr. Moss for relief under chronic and under AEDPA. The second problem with the state court's decision that I would point to is the fact that when the state court was purporting to apply chronic, what it said was that Mr. Steingold made a reasonable decision to pursue an expedited stipulated facts bench trial and focus on entrapment. But that analysis is of a specific decision by the attorney, which belongs under Strickland, and it fails to consider the proceedings as a whole. And I think that this example really illustrates why it's important that we have Strickland claims and chronic claims and treat them separately. And that's because Strickland's focus on discrete claims of attorney error runs the risk of missing the forest for the trees. So
let me ask you under chronic, how much do you have to do at trial to avoid a chronic claim as a defense counsel?
So here it's our position that he did nothing to effectively test the prosecution's case.
Well, he cross-examined a witness.
He conducted a cross-examination, but in
that's not
name
enough under chronic.
Because it was a cross-examination in name only and did not actually challenge what the witness had been put on the stand to testify to, we don't think that that is enough to qualify as conducting oneself at trial. So what was at issue, what that witness was testifying to was that the amount of cocaine at issue was an amount that would be enough to infer intent to distribute. And Mr. Steingold conceded that that was true of that amount of cocaine and proceeded to just challenge that witness's expert qualification. So it didn't actually test the case that the prosecution was putting forward in any way.
Well, at least there's this one case, this Bell v. Cohn case from the U.S. Supreme Court. It looked like in that case that the counsel had waived their closing argument, failed to introduce mitigating evidence. The court said those were Strickland errors, not chronic errors. So why isn't that the case here, where these are really just Strickland errors? I mean, there are a lot of them, a lot of alleged Strickland errors, but he didn't completely abandon the client.
Well, so one point that distinguishes this case from Bell v. Cohn is the complete denial of counsel at the critical pretrial phase, which is a distinct claim than about what happened at trial. And I don't think Bell v. Cohn has any bearing on our pretrial claim, because absolutely nothing was done by Mr. Steingold during that phase. As for at the trial itself, I think what's unreasonable about concluding that the attorney actually did anything here is because in Bell v. Cohn, the attorney was doing some things on behalf of his client. And
I guess that's what I'm having trouble with. This counsel was doing some things on behalf of the client. He cross-examined the witness. But you're saying that's not enough. So I'm having trouble. At what point have you done enough on behalf of your client to survive a chronic challenge?
I think that what distinguishes what the attorney did here from what happened in Bell is that the cross-examination that happened, the questions that he asked, didn't actually go to the element that witness was put on the stand to testify to. Because he'd conceded the substance of the witness's testimony, any challenges to his expertise or his credibility were completely meaningless. It's a little bit like if he'd gotten up there and had been asking the witness about his personal life or the news or something completely irrelevant, because it just doesn't bear on the substance of the prosecution's case.
So it needs to be material cross-examination.
We would say so, yes, Your Honor. In order to meaningfully test the prosecution's case, which is the language that Chronic uses, it needs to be related to the prosecution's case. And I think that in terms of I think it's worth emphasizing why Mr. Moss doesn't need to show prejudice under these circumstances, why Chronic doesn't require a showing of prejudice, and that's because the complete denial of counsel at the pretrial phase makes it really hard to suss out what ways in which Mr. Moss was prejudiced later at trial. I can't answer your question about what a different attorney necessarily would have done, strictly because of how incompetent Mr. Steingold was earlier in the trial. And I think that the state court, in concluding that his decision to pursue the expedited stipulated facts bench trial, the court essentially gave Mr. Steingold credit for having pursued the entrapment defense and focused on the entrapment defense instead of focusing on the trial. But that, again, fails to look at the proceedings as a whole and fails to consider whether both the counsel did enough investigation to conclude that entrapment is the right defense and actually litigated the defense. So in the situation where Steingold didn't do any investigation, didn't do any research before showing up for the first day of the entrapment hearing, there was no way for him to know that that was actually a good defense to pursue or how he should go about doing so. And then at the entrapment hearing itself, I think the record of that hearing reveals that he was totally unprepared for it. He effectively got in there and was using the entrapment hearing as a means of conducting discovery. He was asking questions about the players involved, about the timeline of events. He wasn't actually testing the prosecution's case, and he was completely unprepared. It's a little bit like if one of us got up here without reading the briefs or the cases and tried to answer your questions. It's just not advocacy. And by giving him Steingold credit for having conducted an entrapment hearing to the detriment of the trial, the state court unreasonably failed to consider all of the failures up to that point and all of the abandonment up to that point.
So I know we, as I understand it, are to sort of keep the Strickland and Chronic pathways somewhat separate. And the government argues that, you know, much of what you're arguing is Strickland claims that might arise. Counsel didn't do this and counsel didn't do that. But wouldn't it be accurate to say you still have to look at what counsel did to meaningfully, adversarially test the prosecution's case? You still have to look at some of what did not occur or did occur. How do you harmonize those two concepts?
Well, I think your earlier insight was exactly right, Judge Cole, that in order to explain all the ways in which the attorney abandoned Mr. Moss here, we have to sort of enumerate a laundry list of things he didn't do and things he failed to do. And I think that the complete failure to take any action on Mr. Moss's behalf prior to the entrapment hearing is an example not of specific errors, but just of omission from start to finish. And so I think it's...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think that example is extremely easy to see why we analyze that as a chronic claim rather than a Strickland claim. And I think Mitchell v. Mason is very helpful in that regard. As to the remainder of the proceedings, I think that the guiding insight, again, is the observation from Cronick and Strickland that it's not enough for someone who happens to be a lawyer to show up and stand next to the client. They have to actually meaningfully test the prosecution's case. And so there might be overlap in that kind of claim between the types of cases where you could bring, or the types of errors where you could bring a Strickland error for failing to do something, and where that failure is part of a larger abdication by the attorney. But because we're just talking about the chronic claim here, we don't think the fact that this could be, that some elements of our claim could be sliced and diced into individual Strickland errors prevents us from bringing a chronic claim about the holistic effect of counsel's abandonment.
So the cross-examination that Mr. Steinholzer-Goltz did just went to the qualifications of one of those two?
At the trial, yes.
At the trial level? Okay.
Yes, and when I was saying that he was conducting discovery through cross-examination, that was at the entrapment hearing.
Okay.
So that wasn't at trial. My point that I was trying to make there was just that he didn't really pursue the entrapment defense at the entrapment hearing. He just sort of tried to use it to get his bearings, and so he shouldn't get any sort of credit for not having abandoned Mr. Moss at trial because of his efforts to sort of flail around and figure out what was happening at the entrapment hearing.
He also did meet pretrial, though, with Mr. Moss for a couple of hours, right?
Immediately before the hearing, they did speak, yes.
Did he meet with any witnesses at all?
He did not, no. And he didn't ask Mr. Moss any of the questions that he plans to ask him at the entrapment hearing. He just flew blind throughout that hearing. And I think one of the points in the record that particularly demonstrates how unhelpful he was at the entrapment hearing is when he mentions there's a couple witnesses that he'd like to subpoena now halfway through the entrapment hearing. This is at page ID 340 through 42. And the judge asks him where he got the idea to subpoena these witnesses, and he said that he learned about their names during the testimony at the entrapment hearing. Now, I do want to spend a few minutes on timeliness just because I see my time is running down, and I know that's a threshold issue. No timing pun intended. But the point I wanted to clarify about our timing argument is that it's not our position that this panel needs to overrule Bronaugh v. Ohio. We, of course, would not ask this court to do that. Our position is that the Sixth Circuit has not conclusively resolved when the statute of limitations ends. And that's because Bronaugh's statement to this effect was not actually dispositive to the outcome of that case. Bronaugh was about a different issue about whether a motion to reopen a direct appeal is part of direct review or part of post-conviction relief. And in the process, in concluding that Mr. Bronaugh had filed his petition several days early, the court there said that the statute of limitations began to run the day after the conviction becomes final, just as we argue that is the case here. And then it said that the statute of limitations ended, it did in passing say that it ended a year from the day of finality, but that statement did not come with any accompanying reasoning, and it wasn't dispositive because the petition was filed a few days early. And I know that might sound like a really aggressive reading of what qualifies as dicta and what qualifies as a holding, but in this context, I think it's really important to distinguish between the two. And that's because computing time is a hard thing to do, and when there's only a margin of error of one day, the parties in the court might not necessarily focus on the point. And I think that Bronaugh itself actually really illustrates that point. If you look at the final paragraph in the court's decision there, it talks about how the statute of limitations began to run September 10th, 1996, and it ran through April 7th, 1997, a total of 209 days. And then it says that it picked back up again from January 29th, 1998, through June 30th, 1998, a total of 153 days. And if you run that math out, 209 days and 153 days are computed in inconsistent manners. One includes the final day and one does not. And I think that that example of inconsistent statements in the same paragraph, in the same opinion, just goes to show that when the court and the parties aren't focused on whether one day makes a difference, there's a real risk of getting the arithmetic wrong. And subsequent panels should not be bound by those unreasoned statements.
Tell me again where the erroneous computation in the same sentence is.
It's in the last paragraph of Brona, Your Honor, when it talks about 209 versus 153 days. And I just use it as an example of how when the focus isn't on that one day, it can be easy not to sort of give it the attention that it deserves. But Brona's statement that the statute of limitations ended September 9th, 1997, didn't come with any accompanying reasoning. If there's no other questions, we would ask this court to affirm.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Shimkus?
Your Honors, I'd just like to make a few points. So first, this notion of, you know, chronic versus Strickland. I think, Judge Cole, you had sort of touched on this. If the issue isn't chronic, sort of the logical progression from that is to look at Strickland, and then you have to analyze prejudice. So counsel said on the other side, you know, they're only alleging chronic here, not Strickland. So either way, it seems like it could be a problem for them, because if they lose under chronic, then under their answer to your question, then the inquiry just ends. This court wouldn't even need to go to Strickland. But even then, if you do go to Strickland, there isn't any argument for actual prejudice in this case. So really, they're in a tough spot both ways. The second issue is there's been so much talk about trial here, what counsel did or didn't do at trial. But what counsel did and didn't do at trial needs the context of what he did before trial, which was conducting this entrapment hearing. There's also some talk about, you know, how often counsel met with the petitioner in this case, but the petitioner came to Steingold. You know, he signed a fee agreement, I believe it was on September 6th, and then counsel knew at that point, little less than 2 weeks later, was this entrapment hearing, and counsel got an extension here. So counsel knew that this hearing was coming. Counsel knew that the trial was coming. Counsel conducted not just a few hours entrapment hearing. This was a three-day entrapment hearing that counsel conducted with not really a partner in the same firm, but a colleague. They sort of both conducted the entrapment hearing together. So there was a lot of work done.
Is your position then that the fact that they did the entrapment hearing, it doesn't really matter what he did at trial, that was enough to survive chronic?
Not that it doesn't matter what he did at trial, but that it puts in context why he did or didn't do things at trial. So you can still look at the trial. I'm not saying, you know, this court needs to be blind to what happened or didn't happen at the trial, but it needs to be viewed in the right context, which is this entrapment hearing was conducted. The evidence was overwhelming against Mr. Moss here, that, you know, he bought 10 kilograms of cocaine, he wanted to buy 40. The informant said, here it is.
Chronic requires that you just have to look at, like, what was the case against the defendant, and if it was overwhelming, then really the counsel didn't have to do anything at trial?
Not
because he was going to lose anyway, so he just didn't. He could show up, but he didn't really have to do anything. He can survive a chronic claim.
Not that it doesn't matter, Your Honor, but that it informs the counsel's strategy and their decision for doing what they did. And so if they had a reason for doing very little...
What benefit did he give to the defendant by not doing anything at trial? What was the benefit?
So
from any perspective that you can think of.
Sure. So the benefit was that counsel knew he needed to get the issue in front of the Michigan Court of Appeals because this was a legal issue. The trial court had denied the motion to dismiss based on entrapment.
But he could still get it in front of the Court of Appeals if he conducted a full trial too, couldn't he?
Yes, and I think that goes back to this whole notion of there's nothing to lose. Counsel was asked about this at the Ginther hearing, the evidentiary hearing where counsel testified, and he said, well, a trial would have been, I think the language he used was a bit of a charade and really a waste of time because the evidence here was so overwhelming, and the only defense that Mr. Moss had was entrapment. And so the only court that could overrule the trial court on the entrapment issue was the Michigan Court of Appeals. And the only way to guarantee that the Michigan Court of Appeals heard that issue was to have a conviction at trial, not a plea or even a conditional plea, because those would have been by applications to the Michigan Court of Appeals. And the Michigan Court of Appeals could have simply denied leave to hear the appeal. And so there was no guarantee that they would hear the entrapment issue. And so for all those reasons, Your Honors, we would ask that you reverse the decision below for the timeliness issue, the procedural default, and on the merits.
One quick question.
Of course.
So for the entrapment hearing, Mr. Steingold met with Mr. Moss for a couple hours, talked him into going for it with the bench trial. But doesn't the record reflect that Mr. Steingold said he needed three or four other witnesses? He had, I think, a list of the witnesses, never did contact them, did not subpoena them, did not call them for the entrapment hearing. Am I right about that with the record? I guess it would just seem to be, if that's the case, I am just having a hard time seeing how that is any sort of reasonable defense. I know we're looking at this under AEDPA, but you just meet with a client for 2 hours, and you got witnesses that you say you need, and you don't call them.
Well, so he did meet with the client a few hours before. He had also met with him 10 days before to sign this fee agreement.
Okay, so he's met with the client. What about these witnesses?
Right. So with the witnesses, I know counsel had said that he essentially used the entrapment hearing as discovery, but, he had 10 days to prepare. He had the file from the previous counsel. He knew that the previous counsel had talked to these other witnesses, and the previous counsel had recommended to Mr. Moss that he take a plea agreement in this case. So someone had looked into these witnesses, and not just someone, but this attorney had looked into these witnesses and must have at least concluded that they weren't very helpful, because if he was still recommending that Mr. Moss plead guilty.
I thought the Steingold said, I need them. I think he used the word, I need these witnesses.
I think he would have liked to have them to try to develop the entrapment argument a little bit, but frankly, Mr. Moss talked about this at the Günther hearing as well, that he wanted his attorney to talk to these witnesses, but he didn't identify who these witnesses were. And when asked what these witnesses would have said, he said, well, they would have supported my entrapment defense. But that's hard to say, because the issue of entrapment is really an issue of law enforcement versus the defendant. And so there aren't going to be many other witnesses who can try to convince a judge that entrapment occurred. So we ask this court to reverse. Thank you very much.
I appreciate your answer. Thank you very much. We'd like to thank Ms. Barlow and your institution that you're with for your representation as a Criminal Justice Act attorney here. It's a great benefit to our system at large. No doubt your client, Mr. Moss, appreciates your representation today. And, of course, Mr. Shimkus, we always appreciate your representation on behalf of the government. So thank you both, and the case will be submitted.